From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from around the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell your smart speaker to play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the In the Moment Segments podcast. And now for your weekly roundup in news coverage. South Dakota is currently seeing widespread influenza activity across the state. This includes hospitalizations and even deaths. And with coronavirus making headlines, we thought this would be a perfect opportunity to bring in the state epidemiologist, that's Dr. Joshua Clayton, to kind of give us an overview of what we're seeing with the flu season and to give us an idea of how ready the state is if we did see the coronavirus here in South Dakota.
Dr. Clayton, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Let's start with the flu. What can you tell us about how the 2019-20 flu season is shaping up so far in South Dakota?
Well, we definitely are still seeing widespread influenza transmission across South Dakota. We, over the past week, had over 1,700 new laboratory-confirmed cases, as well as 52 hospitalizations and 2 deaths, and that is, you know, our numbers are kind of increasing, and we've not reached that peak yet for our flu season. And so it's important that individuals recognize steps that they can take to reduce their risk of illness. And that would be first and foremost, getting their flu vaccine, taking appropriate respiratory precautions, you know, coughing and sneezing into a tissue or into their sleeve, and making sure that they're washing their hands frequently with soap and water or alcohol-based hand gel.
Same question as always. Is it too late to get your flu vaccine if you haven't done so far? Do we have enough? Is it targeting this flu strain effectively? And what's the, you know, how long does it take to really build up that immunity once you get the shot?
We do know that the flu shot is the best way to prevent illness. It does take about 2 weeks to have that full immunity develop from the time that you receive the flu shot. But it is not too late. We want to make sure that individuals recognize that, you know, we're still trending upward in terms of the number of flu cases that we have, you know, and that means that we still have the other half of the flu season yet to go. So even if you've not gotten your flu vaccine yet, now is a good time to get it.
Right.
And it does do a pretty good job, you know, of preventing the influenza illness. The vaccine efficacy studies just came out last week and showed that overall for influenza A and B, the vaccine is about 52% effective at preventing illness. But that also means that there's some effect on reducing the number of hospitalizations and deaths as well.
How does this season compare to other years? What do we know as far as the hospitalization and the death rate and the activity in general?
We know that, you know, in total, we are seeing more of the laboratory confirmed cases. Some of that is due to a difference in the tests that are being used at clinics and hospitals across the state. They have switched to a different testing type, and so we're actually counting them as laboratory-confirmed cases, where before they were only counted in aggregate. So it looks like our numbers are just drastically higher than we've seen in past years, but that is mostly due to the change in testing that has occurred over the past few years. And so I would caution, you know, if individuals are looking back at the number of laboratory-confirmed cases in past years, just to take that into account. But if we look at our hospitalizations and our deaths, and we have a total of 14 deaths so far this year, and we typically see in a given flu season about, you know, 40 to 60 deaths. So far, we have a lot of transmission, but it has not been quite as severe as in past years.
Tell me a little bit about what you want from people. What's the ideal situation as far as reporting? Because when you start coming down with some of those symptoms and the fevers, do you stay home or do you go to the doctor first regarding your own care? And second, as far as reporting and tracking this kind of information, what does that do for the State Department of Health? So first off, do I go in right away because I can shorten the duration of the flu if I show up at my doctor's? Is that good for me to go in or stay home and wait it out?
You know, it does depend a little bit on, whether you're in that high risk group or groups for more severe complications due to influenza. Individuals who are less than 5 years of age, who are 65 years of age and older, who are pregnant, or those who have chronic medical conditions are at higher risk of influenza complications, including hospitalization and death. And so, that does need to be part of your decision making. The other side of it is that most of the illnesses that we see are self-limited. That by staying home and the big thing is staying hydrated, you are able to weather the worst part of that influenza infection. And most people don't necessarily require going to see a doctor or even being hospitalized due to influenza. The major trigger is, if that fever stays high for a prolonged period of time, or if you or your loved ones are not able to continue, drinking fluids in order to avoid dehydration.
Tell me a little bit about this idea of staying home, because that's an important part of prevention, too. It's a lot of South Dakotans, we show up for work even if we don't feel our best.
Yes, that is so true. It's I think that does kind of represent some of the hardworking individuals that we have here in South Dakota. And the important thing to know is it's not always the best thing to do when you're sick. And that's kind of true for really any of the respiratory diseases out there, but more so with influenza, just because of some of the serious complications that we can see with individuals who are sick with flu. When you do become ill, that fever is going to be probably the number one factor that you'll want to take into account. If you're actively have a fever, which is greater than 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit, that really should be an indication that you stay home and avoid spreading whatever illness it might be, including influenza.
The coronavirus and the news about the coronavirus is certainly complicating how people think about this flu season, and also we're being warned right now to prepare for it. How are we preparing? Where do you begin as state epidemiologist?
We have been preparing for quite some time now. This is not something that has really kind of come out of the blue. We have known about the novel coronavirus and its transmission within China since early January. The state is monitoring the situation. You have seen some of the reports in national news about state departments of health monitoring individuals who have returned from China, and that those individuals, starting the first part of this month, first part of February, are being monitored by public health officials to make sure that those travelers don't develop the symptoms of novel coronavirus. So we are really looking at our individuals developing a fever, cough, or shortness of breath that might indicate that the novel coronavirus has spread to the lungs. And so we have been monitoring the situation, been working closely with CDC, helping keep informed our healthcare partners to make sure that they are prepared if we have an individual that needs to be evaluated, and what that means for testing and what that means for the public health follow-up. really to make sure that individuals who had been exposed to a case of this novel coronavirus are notified and allowed to self-monitor for infection. We're at a little bit of a review point in our planning. We have seen the novel coronavirus spread from China to other parts of the world, South Korea, Italy, Iran, and the Department of Health and the CDC and healthcare and other folks are now ratcheting up our planning efforts to make sure that we're able to prepare for additional introductions of novel coronavirus into the state.
Do we know if we have any people in South Dakota who have been notified of their exposure who are currently quarantined in the state or elsewhere?
So what we do know is that there have been 15 total cases in the United States. That has not included South Dakota. Those states that had novel coronavirus cases from returning travelers included Arizona, California, Illinois, Massachusetts, Texas, Washington, and Wisconsin. So it has been a very limited number of states. Individuals may have also seen some of the discussion of bringing U.S. citizens, back to the United States from Wuhan or from the Diamond Princess cruise ship. There have been additional cases of novel coronavirus identified among those individuals, but all of those cases, have been outside of South Dakota and that they are under isolation to make sure that they do not spread the virus to other individuals. Currently in South Dakota have not had any cases. We've not had any persons under investigation, which would be our suspect cases, and we have not, had to evaluate anyone for who had traveled to China.
Are public health officials rethinking the notion of quarantine and its effectiveness now that we know that this is a virus that is transmitted similar to the flu? It's just very difficult to stop. Is quarantine still what I'm really wondering is at what point is the quarantine not effective as more and more cases are reported?
And that is a very, difficult thing to try and evaluate. We know that one of the best things that we can do, whether we're talking about flu or we're talking about novel coronavirus, is to, for those individuals who are positive with the infection, to reduce their risk of transmission by, isolating them in a hospital or in a facility or at home. The quarantine of individuals has been effective, in the recent past because we've had these limited introductions, and we've had always been able to link back to which cases these new which individuals have been exposed to cases. When we start to have larger sort of community transmission, where we don't know who exposed individuals within the community and have some difficulty in tracking that and establishing that link, that's going to be where quarantine, really does break down, and we need to look at other ways to reduce risk, such as social distancing and making sure that individuals are, keeping their distance from individuals who may be ill.
Does South Dakota have the test kits necessary, the protective gear for healthcare workers necessary to handle a potential novel coronavirus transmission in the state?
That is something that is part of our preparedness plans is to make sure that we're evaluating what we have in stock at all of our healthcare facilities across the state, and reserving that for the care that needs to be provided. So both now and for in the future. And so there are some guidances out there, from CDC that help healthcare facilities make sure that they're using PPE when it's appropriate and where it's appropriate in efforts to make sure that we have always have that PPE available for those healthcare workers and for other individuals who may be providing care.
Can you be more specific about where you're at in that review process? Does that mean we're gathering the numbers and thinking mathematically how many would we have to have? Does that mean we're already prepared for a certain number of cases? Can you just break that down a little further, please, for people?
Sure. So we have already spoken with our hospital systems to identify, what are their PPE needs now, what do they have available to them, either in the hospital or available from their suppliers, to meet current needs and to meet some future anticipated needs. We also have the capability of helping support those hospital systems by, making sure that we're moving the appropriate medical supplies around to make sure to ensure that we have them where they're needed. The other thing, that we always have access to, and this goes, is something that we have just as a larger medical supply, is access to federal stockpiles of, medications and PPE and things like that that could be utilized in an emergency situation. And so, that's something that the federal government manages and, if states request it, is available for situations such as this.
One of the challenges with coronavirus is we're hearing, if you think you have symptoms, stay home. Don't go into your clinic and present yourself there. Stay home and call for some kind of help. And then we just talked about the flu and those people who are, underlying risk factors should go in. People are starting to get confused and a little afraid, even maybe they shouldn't be yet, but that's human nature. If you put it out of your mind for now and just treat it like it's the flu because we're going to know when it comes here. You've got people on cruise ships right now that are coming back to South Dakota. You've got people flying in from all over the world. Help people understand how they should think about this and think about symptoms that resemble the flu or something else if they get them.
We know where the novel coronavirus is currently circulating, and we are doing follow-up with individuals who are at elevated risk of getting sick with novel coronavirus as they travel internationally. So I think there is that separation of, if you have not traveled internationally, and even if you've traveled internationally, not traveled to those countries that have been impacted, you are more at risk of, kind of the seasonal viruses that we see, like influenza. For those individuals that are at some elevated risk, the Department of Health is working to monitor those individuals and make sure that if they develop symptoms that, we're working with the healthcare system to evaluate those individuals for novel coronavirus. Your general South Dakota resident, that is developing, the fever or cough, those are also the signs and symptoms for influenza. And so, need to think of, what sort of risk might you have had? And right now, individuals who are in the community should be thinking influenza. For those who have traveled specifically to the countries where we have novel coronavirus, we need to just make sure that we're taking precautions that it's influenza and not novel coronavirus.
Dr. Josh Clayton is the state epidemiologist. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, most of us have this sense that lawmakers and peer write their own legislation, usually in response to a need from a constituent. Someone brings attention to a problem, they take a look at it, write some legislation, and hopefully it goes through. But that's clearly not always the case, because oftentimes the exact same language in legislation being introduced in peer is showing up in legislation being introduced in other states. So we wanted to get to the bottom of who is writing these bills and who is really being represented when quote-unquote model legislation is being introduced. Let's take a listen.
We're joined now by Rui Kanaya. He's a political editor on the Center for Public Integrity's Money and Democracy team. And Rui, welcome. I think I got your title wrong. Tell me what your new title is.
I think you got it right.
I got it right. Awesome. All right, welcome. Thanks for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about how this project was researched. How did the collaboration work?
Oh, gosh. That goes back to about 2 years ago when we started working on this data project. We basically was having this idea of trying to find out how extensive this model legislation phenomenon is all over the country. We knew bits and pieces of, you know, stuff that surfaced every once in a while, and we wanted to have sort of a comprehensive database that would track any bills out there that's been introduced, and wanted to see how many bills out there that have lots of matching language in it. If not the entirely, you know, the cross matches, but maybe 50%, maybe even 25%. And so we basically set out to do this data work going back to 2010. Any bill that has been introduced anywhere in the country in 50 states, we wanted to download the text and put it into the database so you can actually compare one to the other. And that took quite a bit of work, mm-hmm. but we got it done last year. And so you can look up basically any given bill that you might have in your state and see if that actually has a model bills, you know, anywhere else around the country. What we ended up finding was from 2010 to 2018 that we had the data for, there were something like 10,000 bills that have had very, very close matches to each other in different states. So that was one of the findings, and you can actually find quite a few in South Dakota as well. It's not as many as other states. I'm guessing that's because of the size of your legislature. Sure. Maybe the number of the bills that you guys, you know, introduce may be smaller than the others.
Right. It's a short legislative session, yeah, for one thing. But to help people put this in perspective, it's not uncommon for lawmakers to, you know, look across the country and kind of try to figure out, you know, we have a problem. How are they solving it in Minnesota? But this isn't what this is. This is about really special interest groups writing the text of the bill and working mm-hmm. across the country to try to get their interests into state houses. Tell us a little bit the background of how model legislation really is working. What did you learn?
So it's basically the way it works in a most simplified form is, let's say, some think tank here are in Washington, D.C., they have certain idea about the bill that they like to push across the country. So they just write it up in a way that they would like to get introduced. And they basically have all the lobbyists or whoever they have contact across the country and basically hand a particular copy to whoever who might be friendly to their cause. And that lawmaker in turn basically would put the name on that bill and introduce it on their behalf. You know, different variations happen, obviously. You know, sometimes that particular bill will get changed quite a bit to the point of you probably have three or four paragraphs left over from the original language. But still, the essence of that bill might be there. Or sometimes, you know, the lawmakers will just take that and completely write in a different language, but the essence will be there too. That's harder to detect just because, you know, obviously you have to do a lot more research. Right. But basic idea is that, yeah, these are something that the people have written outside of the legislature, and the lawmaker would basically take it from there for the reasons, you know, because of the ideological reasons or practical reasons, like, you know, well, every year you have to introduce a certain number of bills, or like to introduce a certain number of bills, and doing that from scratch for every single one is a lot of work.
Right.
And, you know, places like South Dakota, many other states across the country, there are part-time lawmakers. You know, they have to make money on the side and do this stuff on, you know, when the legislature in session. So sometimes it helps to have the work done for you to some extent, and maybe if they can actually just put their thing on that, great. Or if they're lazy, they can just introduce that pretty much up there.
Right. So in South Dakota, we usually say we have a citizen law, citizen lawmakers, which means these people have full-time jobs. They're farmers, they're insurance agents, they're doctors, they're law enforcement officers. They work in their communities, and then for 3 months out of the year, they're in peer legislating. Although the work of legislation happens year-round in developing bills and other additional studies and duties, their main job is almost always something other than being in the South Dakota State legislature. I want to talk about a case study that you wrote about, and this is, again, not something that we've seen, as far as I know of, in South Dakota, but I think for listeners it will help identify how this is happening nationwide and how it can be a problem. You wrote about used car auto dealers and disclosures. Tell us a little bit in this, the idea of a case study of what you found with this legislation.
Okay, the genesis of this was basically all the safety recalls that was happening a few years ago, and the Takata airbags that would explode in your face, right?
Right.
Or the ignition switch that GM had with many of their cars. So used car dealers had lots of those cars sitting on their lot, and in many cases they couldn't sell them because, well, they're frankly dangerous. So they basically got together and came up with this bill. Basically, they call this a sort of a transparency bill because it would require them to disclose that there is a safety recall on them. But so long as you do that, you are authorized to actually sell to the customers without fixing those safety recalls. Sounds like, a good idea to an extent, because if you're going to sell them, well, you might as well let them know. So that's how they were selling this, except when you talk to the watchdog people, then they would say, well, this is basically giving them a kind of legal loophole. They can now say if they get sued later, somebody get injured or whatever, and, well, you can tell to the judge, like, hey, we did everything that state lawmakers made us do, and we disclose all this stuff. So basically, this is the legal cover for them to keep selling this.
Right.
So that was pretty dangerous stuff. And I found at the time, it's been almost a year now, 12 different states have introduced it, and two have already passed this bill.
Right. Interesting. So people are buying a car that there was a disclosure, but it wasn't fixed, and then they have the exploding airbag, and fatalities have occurred. So it's life, it's people's lives are at stake with this legislation that's really protecting someone that maybe doesn't deserve that protection as much as the consumer does. What do we know about model legislation in South Dakota? What have you learned?
So I was just poking around our tool this morning just to see what's been introduced recently.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the bills that I noticed had to do with abortion. Looks like this is something to do with the requirement to do certain things before abortion could be provided.
Right.
And so that's one good example. Another bill that I have been reading, this is something that the New Republic magazine wrote recently. It had to do with the service that the doctors will provide to transgender patients. So things like, the kind of healthcare for them, things like the puberty blockers or giving them hormones to treat that. So if they're under age of 16, doctors cannot provide those services. And if they do, they get actually criminal, you know, prosecuted for that. That was passed, I believe, last month in the House, but I think it got stuck in the Senate. So yep. It's kind of where it is right now.
Right. It has been defeated now in the Senate, did not get out of the committee in the Senate. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting mm-hmm. listeners, that's House Bill 1057, which we've been talking about so much. And now one of the efforts, Rui, that you're working on with the Center for Public Integrity is also to look at which lawmakers are doing this, you know, because right now anybody can access this tool online and you can mm-hmm. look up the text of legislation. And even though the algorithm might not pick up everything, if you know that the bill you're trying to sort of see, you can put in, you know, the topic and you can see what's happening across the country. And it's been very insightful. What about the lawmakers themselves? Are you finding there are certain lawmakers who are using model legislation more frequently?
We found that not so much particularly to the South Dakota lawmakers, but we found a few our partners at the USA Today. They wrote a story basically about certain lawmakers in certain states that introduced hundreds of bills like this over the years. And in some cases, he doesn't even realize that he's actually doing it, which is bonkers to me, but that's kind of how it is and how ubiquitous these practices are.
Yeah. Are these donors, is money changing hands? Is it based on an ideology? What's happening behind the scenes with some of the special interest groups?
This stuff, it's really hard to keep, you know, to really know if there's any kind of money exchange being exchanged, you know, unless you do quite a bit of deep reporting on each subject.
Right.
But typically what happened is, you know, you have already a lawmaker in any state that is friendly to your cause, whatever that might be. And, you know, if you are the corporation or the some kind of ideological group, all you need to do is just kind of do some research and see who's, you know, which lawmaker is actually kind of behind your cause anyway. And all you need to do is kind of approach them and just convince that this is a really good bill for you. And most of the time, I think that does the trick.
Yeah. So as journalists here, you know, we are doing the deep reporting on the state legislature. So it's been very useful to us. But it also occurs to me it's useful to a lot of citizens who are just kind of want to know where some of this legislation is coming from and who their lawmakers are really representing.
We are actually updating this database every week, although we've been having a little problem over the last couple of weeks, so it hasn't been updated since late January, but we are fixing that this week. So, but anyway, going forward, we're going to have this updated every week, so as the legislature goes forward, you can kind of keep track of each bill as they get introduced. And, you know, if you are one of the advocates or just a citizen out there, you can do the research and, you know, you can decide to testify on in favor or against any bill.
Yeah. So you're seeing in the research, too, there are conservative topics, what we would traditionally consider conservative issues, what we would traditionally consider liberal or left-wing issues, and some that are mm-hmm. just industry-wide issues. Did you see, you know, is there a balance? Are some groups using it more than others, using the idea of model legislation more than other groups?
Yeah, that one is a little trickier to get into. Our partner at the USA Today, they've done some of that analysis, and they seem to find that the more conservative groups are actually more successful at pushing these legislation. But that could be the fact that they have been doing this longer. You know, very famous organization called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, they've been doing this for decades, and they are sort of the forefront of this movement. And but everybody else is kind of jumping in and doing the same thing. But, you know, since ALEC is a very famous conservative organization, you know, they have been doing this, and they know how to push these things once they draft these legislation. So I'm guessing that they're just better at it for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a story a few months ago about the abortion rights groups who are now jumping in to do the same thing to counter the anti-abortion folks who have been doing this for decades too. But, you know, this is very recent for the pro-abortion folks. So that's kind of interesting. So it kind of goes both ways. But in terms of the numbers, I think conservatives probably would win.
Right. And in South Dakota, we're constantly talking about outside influences and who comes to the state trying to push a political agenda that is not a grassroots agenda at all. You're probably hearing that from across the country, too. Does every state kind of have the idea that there's something about this that feels not democratic to them?
Yeah, so, you know, at the end of the day, this is stuff that happens in the background, right? And there's no, to my knowledge, no state has any kind of reporting requirement after, you know, somebody hands off this particular model legislation to one lawmaker. So it's basically opaque process as opposed to maybe, you know, campaign contributions. You actually have a way to keep track of that for the most part. So, you know, this is something that people say, well, at least we should know. But at the moment, no one actually has a really, really good way to really keep track of that.
Every week, we bring two people onto the show who are really into politics. They're usually either journalists or political science professors. And they come onto the show and sit with Lori Walsh to talk about the state's top political headlines. So let's take a listen to what they went over this week.
Today, we welcome John Schaff and Mike Card. Mike Card is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of South Dakota, and he's joining us from the SDPB studios on the campus of University of South Dakota. Professor Card, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks, Lori, and good morning to Lori and John. Or good afternoon.
Good afternoon. John Schaff is Professor of Political Science at Northern State University in Aberdeen, and he's joining us from the Tom and Danielle Amann Foundation Studio on the campus of Northern. Professor Schaff, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you, and I ditto the good afternoon.
Let's talk to begin with. We've got a lot of education stories here, and they intersect kind of interestingly with this conversation that lawmakers had about funding education or funding prisons. So we'll get there eventually, but let's start with this plan that we've talked about before on this program about overhauling the Board of Regents, which failed, but legislation to ban unions and collective bargaining succeeded so far, is still moving forward in the State House. John Schaff, give us an idea of kind of this whole, banning unions at public universities. We saw it last year start with the technical schools, this year public universities. Provide people with a little foundation for that conversation, please.
Well, first, it's worth noting that, you know, both Michael and I are employed by the Regental system, and I know I'm pretty sure, I'm assuming, well, we're both part of the collective bargaining unit, whether we're members of the union or not, but obviously we speak for ourselves on this. We don't speak for any entity while we're in the moment. But that said, I think what's going on here is there's an attempt over the last handful of years for the legislature to exert some greater authority over the university, or more generically, the higher education system. Will include the technical schools in there as well. Is that, you know, it's often stated that, for example, if the Board of Regents staff in Pierre was a separate university, budget-wise, it would be like a seventh university in the state. It's the budget is very big for the Regental system. I think that's part of what was part of the motivation behind restructuring the Board of Regents in the sense, I think, trying to weaken the Board of Regents as a political entity. I think that was part of it. For one of the parts of that bill was that they were going to ban people who live in a city that has one of the six Regential institutions from being part of a board. Well, obviously, that's a way of getting people who are not as interested in protecting the university system as others are. And I think you see the same thing with the collective bargaining thing. It's a way that the state can have greater control over what goes on the universities. If the faculty are not allowed to unionize and then speak as one through our collective bargaining unit, COHE, in negotiating the terms of our employment, well, then what will happen is then a contract, in essence, gets dictated to us what is now collectively bargained will be something that will simply be dictated to us by the Board of Regents, and there will be no negotiation. That's way of, I think, streamlining would be maybe a kind way to put it. And certainly, you know, the state being able to exert more influence over what happens in higher ed.
Mike Card, are they going for K through 12 educators in the next legislative session? Do you see this as a potential walking from tech schools to higher ed to K through 12 teachers and their collective bargaining rights?
Well, it was certainly mentioned during the legislation that removed the right to bargain collectively by the technical school faculty. Mm-hmm. And I would suspect that if I were a K-12 administrator, I would be looking forward to not having to collectively bargain with K-12 school teachers.
All right, let's go from higher education way back to the beginning and early childhood education, because Representative Aaron Healy, a Democrat from Sioux Falls, District 14, once again brought a bill saying let's have a council to study the accessibility and affordability and impact of early childhood education. That was rejected. And I bring it up now not because it failed, but because it also reminds us that yesterday in Rapid City, voters declined to pass a school bond to help improve their elementary schools that really had a high threshold for what needed to pass, and that failed. And then lawmakers had this conversation about presumptive probation. If you listen to that debate on the floor, you heard a lot of talk about, I think Chris Langer, who voted against it, a Republican Party leader in the Senate, said, you know, we're going to be asked to fund a women's prison. We're going to be asked to fund more, you know, more jails and incarceration. We really should be funding treatment. And by the way, we have to, you know, we want to provide those cost of living raises for teachers and state employees and providers. So there's this interesting, you know, conversation that harkens back to the, you know, the old axiom about funding schools or funding jails and prisons. A lot converging here in this conversation. Mike Card, where do you want to start with that thread?
Well, I think one thing is I suspect we could speak about the Rapid City bond issue. The proponents achieved about 57% of the vote to fund a bond issue. 60% of the vote is required, what's called a supermajority or a substantial majority. There was 13 inches of snow in Rapid City yesterday. My political science-y type background says that if you want bad weather, because usually the opponents stay home when there's bad weather. So I suspect that that there just isn't much support. You know, and part of what we deal with in many areas of South Dakota is a bimodal distribution of income. And with yesterday's talk where you had Tanchi Weaver on, I believe that was yesterday, mm-hmm. You know, your conversation suggested that they didn't know what was going on, and you tried to lead Ms. Weiner to recognize that there was plenty of information available on how the funds were going to be spent, what they were going to be spent for, and it appeared to me that she was having none of it.
You know, I think that's a fair assessment of the conversation, yes. Yeah.
You know, and again, you know, one of the things that you haven't mentioned is that South Dakota Public Broadcasting supplies the video or the audio of all committee hearings so people can find things for themselves. This is another one that you can listen to the interview and find out the arguments that were given. And basically, Rapid City hasn't funded a bond issue. They've used higher interest rate tax anticipation notes and the like since 1973 to fund their improvements in schools. The suggestion that we can, you know, hire a school sentinel to improve safety in our schools is in and of itself a fairly controversial idea, rather than restricting access to the school by people from the outside. So, you know, I think in politics we do trade-offs, and the trade-off with a bimodal distribution of income is there are lots of people that don't have very much money, and $20 a month in increased property taxes might be prohibitive. On the other hand, we want better schools, because we're not going to have a better lifestyle if we don't at least get a primary and secondary education that enables us to function in our society.
John Schaff, anything you want to add to that, or do you want to jump on to presumptive probation and expand on that a little bit?
No, I'll just say one thing is that I guess we'll dovetail into presumptive probation is what Michael's getting at is, you know, politics is all about priorities. At least it's largely about priorities. And so whenever you're dealing with these issues like the bond issue in Rapid City, it's a statement of priorities. And one of the proponents of the bond issue, so person on the losing side, after the vote yesterday said that the oddity that if they would have been voting to build a prison, it would have passed because they only need a simple majority to build prisons. But to spend extra money on schools, we need super majorities to opt out and to raise money for schools. And so that's a statement of priorities. And so what South Dakota happens to be a very tax averse state. And that means you really have to push people to get them to see the good of your priority if that priority means extra revenue, if it means extra taxation. And it seems like the fellow couple percentage points, what was it, 56%, I guess, was the vote in Rapid City. They fell short. And so it's all about convincing people that this is really a priority that the state needs to get behind in all the various iterations that education takes place within the state and local government.
All right, let's talk presumptive probation, because this is I watched this live on SDPB TV last night, and it was in a very interesting debate on Senate Bill 6, and it passed 19-16. And when they were doing the yeas and the nays, I was trying to count, and I was like, I lost count. It's too close. And fortunately, the Senate did not lose count. So it move on to its next stage. But this is Jason Roundsburg's bill, and he brought a presumptive probation bill last session, and it failed. And one of the things that I found compelling about this testimony was Senator Lance Russell's kind of plea that it's time to support the Attorney General, and still 16 people said not on this one. So let's talk a little bit about the influence of Roundsburg and what he's trying to get through and how successful he's being at first. Mike Card?
Well, I think perhaps the first thing to do is to explain what presumptive probation is for people, and that is if you're convicted of a minor drug crime, that you are placed on probation, hopefully where you can, if you admit help, you can go to one of the unified judicial system's drug courts and get yourself straight with the world so that you can be a productive member of society. If you, without presumptive probation, you know, the presumption is that you'll get probation and have supervised release where you have to report to your probation officer. If you don't cooperate and you don't agree to those things, such as you fight the charges, are still convicted, then you would be incarcerated in the state penitentiary for a period of time. So presumptive probation is trying to keep people out of the prison system where they don't learn new bad habits to go with the bad habits they already have, and to try to get people straight. So I think that's important to understand. The issue of Attorney General, I can never pronounce
Roundsburg,
his name.
Roundsburg.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is to try to get cooperation. And I think Judge Rush last night on the debate noted, you know, if cooperation, which doesn't seem to be defined in Senate Bill 6, means that we want you to go in and make a drug buy. He noted, well, that's exactly what we shouldn't be doing to someone who has a drug habit, is putting them in a position. If they're threatened by revealing information about their supplier of drugs when they were ostensibly the reason for which they were convicted, their family may be threatened and they may choose, My family can have violence, or I can go to jail. I think I'll choose jail. That's a Hobbesian choice. There's no good answer to that particular one, and I'm not sure what we're trying to accomplish with eliminating presumptive probation, other than locking people up.
civil war in Syria has been going on for 9 years. And since December, 1 million people have been displaced. We decided it was time to get an update about what's going on in Syria. So we reached out to Dr. Timothy Shorn. Let's take a listen.
Tim Shorn is an associate professor of political science and director of international studies at the University of South Dakota. He's been helping us understand this humanitarian crisis in Syria for some time now, even as that crisis continues to expand beyond our attempts to put it into any kind of meaningful context. United Nations humanitarian leaders have called the refugee crisis a horror show, and that feels particularly accurate today. Dr. Shorn joins us from the STPB studios in Vermilion. Tim Shorn, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
One of the risks of this story is, when I told people we were talking about it today, is hearing the, is there something new? Hasn't that always been what's going on? It is still developing. There are new refugees. What is the update?
Well, I think you captured a lot of it, that since the Syrian government with their Russian allies have decided to eliminate the last real rebel stronghold in the Idlib governorate, we have seen an incredible humanitarian crisis transpire. We have close to 1 million people, or right around 1 million people, who have been internally displaced. They essentially have nowhere to go. The numbers I have seen said that out of those 1 million people, 60% of them are children. So we're looking at 600,000 children who have been displaced from their homes. They're going to be going to camps where there is very little shelter, certainly no educational opportunities, very little health care, shortage of food. And so this is what we're looking at for an incredible chunk of the Syrian population, and especially hard on children. We have seen the Russians target and attack hospitals because that's a great way to destroy the spirit of the people, and it prevents the people from staying because there's no one to care for them in case of injury or sickness. And certainly the Syrian government is not going to hold back when they attempt to eliminate any pockets of rebellion. So this is, as bad as this is, it's probably going to get worse, and especially since we're watching this occur during the winter as well.
It seems like this violates everything that we think should be allowed as a military strategy, because that's what it feels like it is. What am I missing?
Well, you're not missing anything. They are, in fact, war crimes. They violate the Geneva Conventions. They are considered under customary international law to be war crimes. And the reason that they continue is that there is no one really to hold the Russians or the Syrians accountable. There are a couple of ways to do that. One is legally, the other is kind of politically. Legally, there is almost no chance that any of the Russian leadership or Russian military members or the Syrians will end up in the International Criminal Court. And we have essentially watched any political pressure dissipating. Certainly the American administration is not saying much about it. We're not hearing much from other leaders around the world. And so both Assad and Putin know that they can act with impunity, that no one is going to hold them accountable for the war crimes. And they have 9 years of experience to back that up.
President Donald Trump tweeted that we're very smart not to be involved. So from the Democrat standpoint, from the current administration, there is this void. What is your sense of why that void exists?
Well, I think to a great extent they're representing the American public. For the most part, the American public don't care what's happening on in Syria. We oftentimes fall back on the canard of, oh, it's always been like that there. They've always been killing each other, which is not just an oversimplification, but incorrect. And it completely dismisses any humanitarian responsibility we have to help take care of those who have been displaced. Clearly, the Democratic candidates know that there is no traction to be gained by taking a strong stance on what's going on in Syria. And President Trump knows that there's no price to be paid for by him or his administration or his campaign by essentially ignoring what is going on. So I think essentially it's a cost-free decision on the part of the the political leaders and candidates to simply ignore what's going on in Syria. And I would not expect that to change between now and Election Day or after.
For people listening to you say that and are disgusted by that, who say that's not acceptable, as an American, as a United States policy, what's the alternative? What are some of the things that, if there was an appetite, that the United States could effectively do?
Well, one of the things that the international community needs, and I think the UN and other NGOs have been very upfront about this, are additional supplies. They need tents. They need blankets. They need clothes. They need medical supplies. And what we have to realize is that these people who have been displaced over the last 90 days or so, some of them were displaced earlier and escaped to Idlib. Now they're being displaced again. Additionally, a considerable part of that region is being displaced. They are not going to get to go home. We have to remember that there are already at least 12 million Syrians displaced. That's well over 50% of the pre-war population. Most of them are not going to get to return because the Assad regime isn't going to let them return. Consequently, we have a significant population that will be living either in refugee camps in other countries or in internally displaced persons camps within Syria. And they're not going to be cared for. The children aren't going to be educated. And what we're going to see over the long run then is a hotbed of radicalism, because it's going to be a great place to recruit a future generation of terrorists. So what the United States and others need to be doing is creating a safe place for these internally displaced persons and assist the countries who have accepted over 6 million refugees to ensure that we are not just preparing for the next round of conflict down the road, since we have essentially ignored what transpired in Syria since it began. So I think really what the United States needs to do is step up and help with the humanitarian crisis. And the Trump administration has exhibited no desire to do that. And so if Americans want something to be done, they essentially have two choices. They can start ringing the phones of their representatives and senators, or start donating to NGOs who have a presence on the ground there.
The Assad regime is arguing that it's terrorism that they're trying to root out, and they're going after terrorist cells. Is their response proportionate to the threat they are facing?
No. And whenever we hear the word terrorist anymore, it's essentially a way to delegitimize the people who are opposing you or competing against you. And this is something that the Assad regime has resorted to for the last 30 to 40 years, if not longer, actually longer, that anybody who opposes the Assad regime is, by definition, according to the Assads, a terrorist. And that ignores the fact that the Assad regime has been incredibly oppressive and brutal. And so their response, going back to the early 1980s, even late 1970s, has always been incredibly brutal and oppressive. It's what Thomas Friedman referred to as the Hama rules, where in the early 1980s, the city kind of rose up against Assad, and the elder Assad simply had it destroyed. And his son has picked up that particular mantle and path, and he is going to do everything he can to destroy not just those who have opposed him, but also those who are members of the religious community or ethnic community of those who opposed him. And so what he has done is not at all proportionate to what has been threatened against him. And in fact, I mean, when we look at the types of actions that the Russians, along with the Syrians, along with their Russian and Iranian backers have taken, they have been they've been committing war crimes since essentially day one of the civil war. So, and that's what the Assad regime is going to continue to do. certainly after the end of the Civil War into an a period where they can root out any type of opposition or suspected opposition. So I would expect the killing to continue even once the Civil War comes to a close.
What does Russia gain?
Well, one, it gives him a major foothold into the Middle East that Russia had, you know, they had a toe print earlier. Now they have an incredibly large footprint in the Middle East, and they are not going to let Assad forget that he won because the Russians entered the fray. What the Russians get to do as well is to enlarge their Navy base in Syria, which is their only base on the Mediterranean. They are building up bases for their Air Force and for their Army. And so what we're seeing currently and what we will see at the end of the day is an incredibly large Russian military presence in Syria, which allows them to try to pressure or influence events in the Middle East, in the Mediterranean, and certainly looking north into Turkey and the Balkans as well. So it's giving them a great jumping off point for expanding their interest throughout that region.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you have a story idea, please shoot us an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. And just a heads up, we're also trying something new. In the Moment is now a YouTube channel where you can watch some of our interviews. I have heard some people are saying they're having trouble finding the channel. So if that's you, shoot us an email and we will send you a direct link. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Chris Lawfrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thanks for listening.